Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Come on, Alex! They're here!
Alex Rogan had a dream.
You really are leaving here, aren't you?
To be as far away from here as possible.
You get your chance. When it comes, you gotta grab it with both hands.
It started with a game.
You're gonna bust the record.
But it wasn't just any game.
You have been recruited by the Star League to defend the frontier against Zur and the Kodan Armada.
And then, one night...
Centauri's the name. We have to talk about a matter of utmost importance. Step into my office. I've seen him come and I've seen him go, but you're the best, my boy. Light years ahead of the competition. Hey.
Alex didn't find his dream.
Hey, look out!
Oh, dear. Hey.
His dream found him. Every Earthling who's ever imagined traveling beyond the stars.
Maybe there is a starfighter left.
I love you, Alex Rogan.
Comes the unforgettable story of one who made it. The last starfighter.
It is 28 minutes after the hour of one, and this is the month of February in the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed, yet not overly ostentatious, studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milkpacking district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good things and fire. If you'd like to join us today, it's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. If you'd like to get on board with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, notes about your girlfriend's replacement parts, whatever it is you got coming up in your life, your hopes, your dreams, your ambitions, all the things that make you so very special. Yeah. You can do that at 503-505-6964. Here's the thing. Some days, one of these days, that guy's going to be, and I say this, you know, with the utmost respect and courtesy and everything, one of these days that Bruce Williams is going to die, and then that observation that I do, the thing, the little Bruce Williams little riff I do, it's going to be poignant for like a week and a half, and then it's just going to be a thing that only old people know about. It's just going to be a thing that I say, and nobody even knows what the hell I'm doing. Well, okay. That's in the future. Today is not that day.
It's pertinent.
That's right. We have an update from the guy whose girlfriend was getting her elbow replaced. So we're going to read that here in just a second. Screw it. I'll read it now. Rick, despite the epic fail on the call you made, I'm sorry. He says, thanks, Rick. Despite the epic fail on the call, comma, says Fletcher, you made my girlfriend laugh before she went in for surgery to have her elbow replaced yesterday. Or this morning. I guess it was early this morning it was happening. More importantly, you scored a few points. Best show ever.
And I received an email from the girlfriend.
Really? Did she sound all doped up?
Her name is Michelle. They're in Canada, by the way.
Oh, I see. So it was probably... So they probably got the elbow free.
Right.
From some sort of socialistic government.
Some kind of high-quality space-age medicine that they paid, like, pennies for. And she says, hey there, Don. I've been listening to both Legion of News and the Rick Emerson Show since it started and look forward to every day.
Woo!
Always so much fun. And wanted to compare wounds with our joint replacements. She's had arthritis for too many years and had both her knee replaced and one of her ankles. And says, tomorrow I'm going in to get my elbow replaced. my boyfriend, who is the one who got me listening, wants me to save my elbow joint after hearing you how you saved your hip joint.
Awesome.
It will be interesting to see if they can. I don't think there will be as much to save from the elbow.
Well,
We have a listener who brought me in a dog femur part from a dog hip replacement. So if you know, and that's a fairly small little bone. They were able to save that. So I'm sure they can save the elbow part.
And I mean, when our friend Scott came in, he brought us, what did he bring you? Like a woodchuck skeleton or something? What the hell was it?
I think it was a beaver skull or a gopher skull?
No,
gopher
it was a
skull.
I thought it was an entire little creature.
No, it was just the skull.
It was just the skull.
It was like a gopher skull.
It was a gopher, a squirrel or something. Yeah. And I mean, you know, that's not like that's huge, but it's still impressive.
Yeah.
It's not the size of the thing. It's the nature of the thing.
It's the thought that counts.
It's the uniqueness of the thing, really. I mean, that's what it's all about.
I almost brought that dog femur part, by the way, to poker last week. Because, you know,
as your card holder?
Everybody has their little toys and their little figures they put on their cards and stuff. And I was going to bring mine out and wait for someone to ask and say, "Why, that's the ball joint from a dog's hip."
And then just kind of rub it on the cards when nobody, you know, just slack moments just to sort of make people, to play the mental game, make people unnerved about holding the cards in their hands later on. I was telling, when we were at Scott Daly's house playing, we're getting ready to go play in the poker game, Laura was walking around the house because she couldn't find, I think she eventually located it, but she couldn't find her Binion's chip, her chip from Binion's card room, which is what she usually uses as her card holder. And so I was just making all of these absurd suggestions that I thought would be sort of great. Like, I was just suggesting that they all be, like, outsized objects. That she bring in, like, you know, like one of my life-size polyurethane skulls from the office at home. Or just a brick. Or just something huge. Or that she escalated, actually, over the course of the next few months as she plays more poker. That if she, it eventually should just be, like, a giant goblet that looks like the underside of that thing from the Close Encounters movie. And it just spins and rotates and has, like, dry ice inside and smoke pours out of it.
I was just thinking, though, I think during the next... God, it would be great to get, like, something... Like a brick and chip off various size pieces of it. And over the course of the
Assemble it.
Well, surreptitiously, just sort of, like, start with a little chip. this is a piece of brick from the house where I grew up. You know, and then like, yeah, and then, you know, during like when we swap out for the blinds go up or something, kind of reach down and get the next larger one and keep putting it and see how long it takes for someone to notice that the brick piece is getting larger and larger.
You've got an entire wedge of concrete sitting in front of you.
Eventually, by the end of the game, there's just a whole brick. Like, wait a minute.
The best part, by the way, and I wish I'd been... there's just moments where you just fall into some alternate reality, or not even an alternate reality, just a hyper version of this reality, like some sort of an exaggerated take on your actual life, and you realize that it's not even that you've just become a parody. It's that, like, you have been a parody of yourself all along, but there are only certain moments where it's really underscored. And that moment at Scott Daly's house a couple weeks ago was when there was this huge box of Star Wars figures being passed around the table because any number of people... Because it's not... Like, the thing about it, the card holder, it's presumably there so when the cards are dealt out or if the people muck their cards or they throw their stuff, that the cards don't get mixed in.
Yeah.
That it weights your cards down a little bit so that other cards can't slide into them accidentally, and then you go, which of these five cards are my two or whatever? But really, it's just become a good luck thing or like a superstitious item for people where they got to have it or else the game goes squirrely for them. And B, it's just a way for people to demonstrate their own quirky personality. It's kind of like it's become a bumper sticker sort of thing. And I don't say that to be snarky. I'm just saying it's a thing via which you can show off different facets of your own persona. And maybe, you know...
Bobby grabbed, Fat Boy grabbed the R2-D2, and he had that. And I grabbed some guy, and then I was told sternly that he was, like, a guy who works on the Death Star, so he was a bad guy. And I'm like...
Do you have Mace Windu?
And eventually I settled on Mace Windu because I have that Sam Jackson thing on my iPhone, so I could, like, make him say things.
So whenever you get cards, you would just go, "Hell yeah!"
Exactly.
That's what I'm talking about!
Yes.
I forgot all about that. That was awesome.
Because any situation, I can generally find a way to make myself the most irritating person at the table.
And then you would just... But then there was this thing where guys would get, like, a terrible hand, like Pirate Dan or whoever, he would just... Like, he'd get, like, you know, like a 7-3 offsuit or something. He'd go, "Well, this isn't working at all. This, you know..." And he would angrily sort of throw, you know, like... He'd throw, like, his Luke Skywalker figure in, then he'd sort of rooting around trying to find, you know...
Right.
"Where's the Boba Fett?" Or he'd, you know, trying to... Or he would have, like, a... Like, if somebody at some point had a job Jawa. It was like Scott Galley or somebody. He's like,
yeah.
And he actually said, this Jawa's not bringing me any luck at all. Like, angrily stuffed it back into the box. And then he ended up with this tiny little die-cast metal version of that. Of that huge, huge thing the Jawas drive around on Tatooine that they suck up R2-D2 mm-hmm. and C-3PO with, that big sort of pointy...
That was Prime. Didn't he have that?
Maybe. Yeah. But it was whatever that vehicle is called, that the scrap metal vehicle that the Jawas are driving.
Fan thingy, yeah.
So that just looks at the car, and then between hands, sort of at slack moments, he would just sort of take it, and he's a grown man. He's like 70 years old. He would just go, and just wheel it across the table, and then ram it into other action figures, and we're all like 100 years old.
Yeah.
So, anyway, well, I don't even know what I was talking about. What is his girlfriend's name?
Michelle.
Fletcher's girlfriend, Michelle. So, Michelle, glad you made it through the surgery okay. And I'm not sure if she sent this before or after the surgery. It sounds like it may have been before she went in. But hope things turn out all right. And you let me know if the doctors let you save that elbow, because we'd like to see a photo of it.
Yes.
Because, I mean, when are you ever going to get a chance to see a picture of somebody's elbow? Like, never.
She sent this at 7 o'clock last night, so she's probably...
maybe in surgery now?
Doing it right now.
All right. Well, see, here's the thing. If she's sedated at this point, then it's like Fletcher, the boyfriend, if you're listening... there via your handheld device or whatever in the great land of Canada, you could remind the doctor, like, oh, by the way, she wanted me to ask, you know. So whether or not she made the request, you should follow up, give it like a supplemental request to keep the elbow, just, you know, to have it floating in a jar for a while, even if you didn't keep it forever, just long enough to unnerve a good number of people, and then it's sort of done its job.
Yeah.
So all right. So forth. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for coming by. It is Wednesday, and welcome to Day 12. You can email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. You can also email Dawn Taylor. It is Dawn, D-A-W-N, Dawn@rickemerson.com. Text box on the website is open. Skype is up and running. That is Rick Emerson Show via Skype. Rick Emerson Show via Skype. Hey, here's a question I have for you.
Uh-huh.
Is it now considered poor form or perhaps racist to have that "We Are Siamese If You Don't Please" song playing from, what is it, Lady and the Tramp?
Yeah, I don't know if it is or not. I assume it probably is, but it delights me.
I have no idea. I just realized that I said some phrase just now, very somewhat akin to "if you please" or "if you like." And then in my head, it started this whole chain reaction of thoughts going back to about 3 weeks ago when Laura and I were in the car driving back from, I don't know, somewhere, like Fry's or something. And out of nowhere, out of the blue, just out of the void, she began singing the "We Are Siamese If You Please" song. Like, and it was like, I don't even think we've been talking. I think we've been sort of driving along, just sort of enjoying the view, letting the silence and the sound of the car just sort of carry us off into our own thoughts. And then she just began singing the "We Are Siamese If You Please" song. And I did kind of the slow turn and looked at her, and I couldn't figure out why. And then we had this big discussion about whether or not, it is Lady and the Tramp, right?
I think so, yeah.
Whether or not it was considered a racist or inappropriate depiction of Asian folk.
It probably is.
Because they're slightly villainous, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then it's kind of this ding, 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 you know, music, of course, you know, which has to accompany anything that's Asian. You know?
So the white man's only way of depicting any part of Asian culture is just to have a plink, plink, plink thing happening in the background. I'm already throwing out way too much. We're never going to get to all this. Monkey Watch coming up today. Penis Watch coming up today. Corpse Watch coming up today. Ms. Kelly Clark, arts and culture editor from Willamette Week, will be joining us later on, about 20, 25 minutes from now. They'll be talking about... she's going to be talking about the Neil Goldschmidt thing. So I guess I didn't realize this. So back in January of this year, like three, four weeks ago, I guess the woman at the heart of the story actually died. Did you know that?
No, I don't think I did.
I actually didn't know that at all. I got it right here. She said she died of complications from long-term drug abuse in January. So this apparently is one of the things, I don't know that if that was not known, but that is discussed in the new issue of Willamette, and so they got a whole huge article about it. And I do see that was it you that noted that Margie Belay from the Oregonian was trying to get her scoop on, trying to beat them to the punch?
Somebody mentioned that.
I guess Cheryl mentioned it yesterday, that Margie Belay was trying to get out in front of the Willamette on this, because Willamette, they were the ones who really broke the story.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, they kind of own that. And they brought Margie Belay, who I think got fired from the Oregonian like a year and a half ago and has just been at home plucking petunias out of her garden or whatever she does.
Well, she and Jonathan, what's his name, had like such a long ride.
Jonathan Nichols.
Not Jonathan Nichols, just you know, for a long time, people who worked at the Oregonian, the nickname for the Oregonian was the Velvet Coffin, saying that pretty much, you know, there was no way you could get, like, fired or laid off from the Oregonian, that once you were hired, you had a job, like, forever. And in the last couple of years, we've learned that that's really not necessarily true. But, yeah, Jonathan Nicholas and Margie Boulay coasted on their, you know, those columns that they had for an awfully long time.
Well, Margie Boulay was sort of the Charles Schultz of the Oregonian. It was just sort of a thing that people read deliberately, you know, not by accident, you know, for, I don't know, like in the 1970s. And then I think she either got tenure of some kind, whatever the equivalent of tenure is of the newspaper,
yeah,
or they just forgot that she was there. Sort of like the X-Files.
Oh, yeah, we got this space that belongs to Margie Boulay. Yeah, we got it. And she just kept sending them in.
Right.
So they kept sending her a check.
It's just, you know, sort of like Seinfeld the first two or three years it was on the air. It just escaped cancellation because I think that section of the magnetic strip board in the studio headquarters was covered up by a potted plant or something, and they just didn't realize it was even around. Here's the thing about Jonathan Nicholson and the Oregonian. I don't even know if he still writes for the Oregonian. Is he gone?
No, he's gone.
Did he? Yeah. Was he asked to leave, or did he?
He. When they started making cuts a couple of years ago, one of the first things that went was him.
He was a nice guy. He actually did a couple really nice pieces on me over the years, and you know, so he's, you know, good guy, but sort of strangely mannered, and I don't mean in the sense that he was polite. I mean in that he had an odd, very deliberate, strangely formal way of talking, even in the most casual of conversations. He also looked a lot like that guy, and I don't know the actor's name, but he's the guy in Glengarry Glen Ross that Ricky Roma basically seduces in the bar and sells real estate to. And he's going, "Glad I met you, George. I'm going to show something to you. It may mean something. It may not. I don't know. I don't know anymore." And then he comes in the next day and goes, "I have to cancel the deal. My wife, she won't let me. I can't. I don't have any power. I just can't." Jonathan Nicholas looks exactly like that guy.
From reading his column and just the photos I saw of him, he always struck me as someone who just desperately, desperately wished he'd been born British.
Or just born like at the offices of the New Yorker.
Yes.
But you were really right about the British thing. I could in some like, I don't know, British version of this show, they're probably talking about a columnist who just walks around and just farts a lot and just has a cigar jabbing out of his mouth and who, you know, clearly should have been born like in the Bronx or something. So you are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Monkey Watch, Penis Watch, Corpse Watch, Kelly Clark, and Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you.
Oregon is indeed going to start harassing sea lions.
Well done.
I've been threatening to talk about this for days. I'm going to finally. A huge winter storm is bringing blizzard conditions to Chicago, and a player's leg snaps during a basketball game.
Really?
Really.
Do we have? What do they say in the newspaper? In the newspaper racket, do we have wood on that? What's the thing where they have art? When you have wood on a story?
I don't know. I don't know what that
in the movie
is.
In the movie The Paper.
Oh,
they
I
say
don't
that.
Remember that.
They Robert Duvall. They're in the budget meeting, I believe they call it, where they talk about what's going to be in the front page of the newspaper or something. And the Robert Duvall character says to the Keaton character, "And do we have wood on the subway accident?" And then he looks over at some guy, and the guy nods and goes, "Yeah, we do."
Oh. That's nothing that was ever used anywhere I worked.
I always assumed that it meant artwork of some kind, or perhaps an interesting quote or a graph.
I don't know. Maybe.
All right. We can't try to answer all these questions today because then we're just never going to get anything else done. Let's see what else we have coming up. Don't forget clue number 3 in the EH Vending Name That Snack Contest coming up later on. EHVending.com is where you find out more about them. That is EHVending.com. It is 503-505-6964. I said that I would do this, so before I get to anything else, I'm going to read this follow-up email from our good friend Seamus, who is weathering the weather in Colorado. Yesterday he emailed to say that it was just unbelievably, like, mind-breakingly cold. And so I sent him an email back last night, and I just sort of, you know, I said, well, you know, it's the thing where you want to go, like, let me know if I can do anything, but really there's nothing. What am I going to do? You know, just send him warm thoughts.
Yeah, mail him an electric blanket.
Yeah, that's pretty much the extent of it. Well, I don't even know that they're, it's one of those things where they say, like, neither sleet nor snow nor whatever, but even though he has recently moved, I was watching the news last night, and it seems like the weather has actually gotten so bad that there were sections where they couldn't even deliver mail. Like the cops couldn't even get out to, like, clear roads and to help people out of their cars and stuff. So when Seamus emailed me last night, this was at 12:45 this morning, he says, "It is now currently 17 below in my neighborhood. It's somewhat warmer closer into Denver. He said the closest I've seen before this was 10 below. The difference between the two feels big. With wind chill, what do you imagine the temperature is at Seamus' home with the wind chill?
Okay, without the wind chill, it's
minus 17 just regularly.
With wind chill, I'll say minus 32.
Minus 35.
Oh, God.
He said, I mostly keep to my basement, and then he puts parenthetically, stereotype. Where my office and home theater are located, and it's the warmest place in the house due to the limited windows and points of entry. He says,
also the best place to ward off zombies.
Exactly. He says, with the boiler down here and the space heater running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it is still only keeping at 65 degrees. So he's got the boiler and the heater running constantly, and it's still only 65 degrees. That's as warm as you can get it. He says, the rest of my house is 38 degrees. That's with the, he said, of course, the rest of his house is all just concrete and there's no wiring and there's no heating. He says, as long as the power doesn't go out, by the way, the power sucks in this city, we should be fine. Otherwise, we'll have to pack up the pets and get to a hotel because then that becomes life-threatening. He says, by the way, I'm not up in the mountains or anything either. This is weather in the middle of a heavily populated city just on the outskirts of Denver. Growing up in Portland, I always dreamed of living somewhere that was cold and gray and constantly covered in snow, South Park style. I have changed my mind, he says. I want the totally reasonable Portland weather back, and I am fine if I never see snow again. He says, P.S., a top five songs about being hot would be welcomed out here this week. So at some point, like Thursday or Friday, we'll get that top five put together for him. So.
All right.
Let's see. Cheryl wants to congratulate us, and by congratulate, I mean mock. She says, well done, news people. How did you not know that that girl had died last month? I don't know. Because I'm busy thinking about Lady and the Tramp all the time, I guess.
I don't know everything. I mean, we really can't know everything.
There's only two of us. We're not ENIAC, for God's sake. All right.
And we're both spending way too much time, like, thinking about snack food and television shows.
Seriously, that's it. Oh, by the way, did you get my text message last night? I put a little something in the Dropbox for you.
I did, and I watched it.
So you did watch, you watched the season 3 Californication finale. Because I had mentioned, this is like what we're doing, a two-parter, like Law & Order Homicide crossover. So on Fun Employment Radio on Monday, we were on funemploymentradio.com with Greg and Sarah, and we were talking about something or other. We were talking about the show Justified, I guess, on FX, and the fact that we're going to have Joelle Carter, who plays Ava Crowder, on Justified. She's going to be on the show next Tuesday. Cheryl got that put together, as she does with all good things. So we were talking about that, and that spun off into a discussion of something or other. I think it was a discussion of True Blood and how Sarah was getting ready to, like, she was gearing up for, like, season 4 of True Blood, which, like, I'm with you. It's like, it was like a forget it and forget it kind of a thing.
I couldn't make it through all of the last season, much less, like, keep going. I just reached that point where I just went, no. Yeah. No. Somewhere around the time that the girl's head got snapped around backwards while she was having sex, I just went, I'm done with you.
I made it through. That, by the way, was the episode that you made me watch. Because I had gotten behind on it, and I came in here like, oh my God.
You have to see this.
I didn't even think I got a good morning out. I was like, hello, Dom, watch this! And it's like, you had it here sitting at your desk, and you have to watch this. I made it all the way through to where there were, like, the water nymphs or whatever showing up. Where she went into, she came out of the bewitching pond on the other side of some dream, and then there was, like, mermaids. And I was just like, F this. I'm done. Yeah. I'm completely done. But Sarah made it all the way through season 3 and has come back for season 4. And Dexter was another show that I made it through season 5 and then decided just to end it. I had been a huge fan of Californication. I loved season 1 and I loved season 2. And when season 3, and it was the thing where I watched season 2 and season 3 kind of late because season 1 and season 2 late because Greg was the one who had told me that I should watch it. He's like, are you watching the Californication show? And I said, oh yeah, David Duchovny. No, I haven't really seen it. And he really kind of gave me the hard sell on it. And I watched season 1, season 2, and really, really thought it was a well-done show and just well-acted and took what could have been a rather blasé premise and merely really kind of made it come alive. And so it's that thing where I power-loaded seasons 1 and 2 just in time to be ready for season 3. And then season 3 bowed, as they say, and was just dreck.
Yeah.
It was just bad. It was so bad. It was, you want to talk about just squandering, just pouring down into the disposal a massive collection of talent and ability. I mean, you look at the acting on that show. I mean, even Duchovny and Handler. The fact that those two guys were just made to sort of you know, zombie march through 11 episodes of just pure unbridled crap.
I made it through three, maybe four episodes of that season before I just couldn't be bothered anymore.
And I know, and part of me feels like a jerk saying that because I know that they had to rewrite a lot of season three at the last moment because Natasha McElhenney, who plays Karen, just as they were getting ready to commence work on the show, she was pregnant at the time, and she went home one day from, like, I don't know, from lunch or something, and her husband was dead. He had died in the hallway of their home, and he was only, like, 40-something.
Wow.
And she went home, and they had two kids already, and she was pregnant. Her husband just keeled over, like, without warning in the middle of the day. And so they rewrote a lot of the early episodes around her absence. That's why those first few episodes, she's, like, on the Skype or whatever from New York, because she was just, like, I think Kapanos actually just said, like, he's, like, stay in New York, deal with your family or whatever, we'll write around it. But it's, like, he is, what do they call it, a writer. You think that he'd be able to come up with something decent with which to replace those early episodes. Or, you know, like, call somebody else who maybe has a good idea.
Yeah.
And he proved wholly incapable of doing that. So I powered through that third season. I mean, we just, like, my teeth gritted and just my fists clenched, just saying, I'm going to get through this just so I can be done with it. Because I find it hard to leave a show halfway through a season. And so then I watched the season finale for season three, expecting, like, nothing. And I really was just astonished. I was just astounded. It was actually not just a great episode, but for my money, in many ways, was the best episode that the series had ever had. And it was actually so good and so satisfying in a strange way that I made the decision then and there that no matter how good season four of that show was and no matter what the reviews said, that I was not going to come back because that was a strong way to go out as a viewer of the show. So you had not seen it, so I put it, gave it to you last night. So what were your thoughts on that?
I absolutely agree with you. I can see why you made that decision because having not watched all of season three, and then I'm starting season four, and I just watched, I think, we're three or four episodes.
Yeah, about a third of the way into it.
Into the new season. And I'm enjoying it. It feels very much like it's come back. Like it's very much true to the same form as seasons one and two. But now that I've seen how they ended season three, like, yeah, because that episode basically just tied up all of the strings, all of the loose ends.
Right.
Essentially closed out everything that they had been doing, you know, since the beginning of the show. And so, yeah, it felt very much like the end of his story.
Do you agree with my assessment that that was probably written before or separate from the rest of the season?
I would say that when they began the show, they knew how they were going they were going to bring it to that point because it just felt very much like a conclusion of everything with, you know, his wife, with his daughter, with Mia.
And we'll give it a little spoiler alert here. So granted, this is a thing that's already aired, but a little spoiler for the end of season three of Californication. But yeah, I mean, they tie up and with Charlie and Marcy.
Yeah.
I mean, everything, all the family business gets taken care of. Did you notice that there were no opening credits?
I hadn't really thought about it. I did notice that because there was a point at which it felt like it was time for the song and the opening credits. And they did like sort of a... They did a little visual thing, little jog, like it was going to go to the credits, but it didn't, and then it just went straight to him in a bar.
Right. No opening credits, and no jokes. I mean, there were really, really not a lot of humor. I mean, there were moments of some, you know, kind of dark and wry humor. There was some little glibness, but there weren't laugh lines anywhere.
The episode actually started with, like, you know, it started with him having, you know, a dream.
Right.
And waking up from the dream, but then waking up from the dream and coming out and having a lovely breakfast with his family and everybody getting along and they're getting ready to move and... You know, but yeah, it's,
I actually, here's how great and how powerful that episode was, you know, just from my perspective as a viewer, that actually, as much as I've raved about it, and I've told countless people who drifted away from that show during the third season, I've given them just the full court press about, you gotta watch it, you gotta go back and watch the third season finale, even if... And I actually told Sarah's friend Kelsey, who was just starting season three, I said, there's going to come a point where you're going to say, F this show, this has gone to hell, and it's become crap. Then feel free to just skip ahead and watch the season finale and just wrap it up then. But it's actually so good that I haven't watched it a second time. A, because it was just so traumatizing, because I didn't expect it. It came out of nowhere. It was just, because again, based on the rest of that season, what would you have expected it to be? You just thought it was going to be more trifles. And also, because it was so well done that I don't want to burn out on it. I'm going to give myself, I think, a good stretch of time and then go back and what, just like I waited on The Wire for a while and Arrested Development before rewatching them because I didn't want to dilute it.
Well, now the problem is that with season four, and which, like I said, I'm enjoying, and I think they're back to the same sort of level of writing that they were doing the first two seasons. But now, having seen that, now I realize that, the whole thing just sort of feels like the further adventures of Hank Moody.
Right.
Because that felt very much like they finished the story.
Yeah.
And now it's like, you know.
And
so now this honestly feels like a sequel or something. This feels like, yes, you know, I'm enjoying watching the characters and watching him and watching, and I'm interested in where they're going to go with it. But I really do kind of feel like, you know, yeah, it could very easily have ended there.
That's why I told you when you said that you had started watching season four, I said, I don't want to know anything about it. I don't want to know. I don't want to know any details because in my... It's like I'm a huge, huge fan of the book Youth and Revolt by C.D. Payne, and the movie, of which is a whole different story. The movie was fairly terrible. But I'm a massive fan of Youth and Revolt. But it's that thing where C.D. Payne, the author, he wrote other books, and some of them very imaginative, and he tried some very risky things and tried to change his writing style dramatically and didn't just immediately go back to the well. But he just couldn't sell anything else. None of his other books moved at all. And so he has now written, I think, at least three and maybe four sequels to Youth and Revolt, each one worse than the last. And it's like I got through the first sequel to that, and I was like, A, I got to immediately scrub this out of my head because it's sullying one of my favorite novels of all time. And also, like, I got to make sure that I just avoid these in the future, like, accidentally. I mean, it was just really... And I get... Don't you think it takes a lot of self-control? It must take a massive amount of self-control if you are a television, if you're a showrunner, to have the willpower to end a show when it needs to end.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because they dangle that money in front of you. And especially, it's not even just the money. It's not the money.
It's like you've got people's livelihoods in your hands. I mean, you've got actors and crew members and electricians and drivers. You know, you've got people who are making a living. And so, yeah, to be able to say, we're just going to shut this all down, and you guys all have to look for new jobs now. On top of the fact that, you know, I mean, yeah, on top of the fact they're talking about, you know, driving a dump truck full of money up to the front door of your house.
Don't you also feel that it's this as well? And I know that we're totally off. We got totally off track here because you have a whole series of mishaps that happened to you this morning. But the good news is we can actually talk about those with Kelly Clark and she'll appreciate them. I don't even know what they are, really. You just gave me just the tiniest little thumbnail sketch of it. So we can we'll move on to that. We'll talk to Kelly Clark here in just a few. We got your Monkey Watch coming up, Penis Watch, Corpse Watch, a whole bunch of other stuff. The other reason I bring this up is because looking at that episode, the season three ender for Californication, and realizing that that is probably, as you said, just like J.K. Rowling, you know, had sort of written the end of Harry Potter before she even began and figured this is how it'll go out. But at some point, Showtime just said, well, hey, here's a bunch of money and we're going to extend the show for a fourth season. And, he just said yes and extended the show probably beyond its natural lifespan, not unlike Buffy was extended 2 years beyond when it probably should have ended. Don't you think it's also that you've seen that movie, The TV Set, with David Duchovny, where it's the whole, ironically, where it's the the whole trials and tribulations of getting a TV show on the air in the first place, where it's not even just the money, it's that, like, the odds, the numbers game of trying to get a show on the air, it's like 1,000 to 1, no matter how talented or funny or great you are, the idea that a script will become a pilot, will become a series, it's like the odds are just stacked against you anyway. So it's like once you get that foot in the door,
you've got to train on the tracks.
Yeah.
Just keep feeding wood in there and just keep it chugging along.
Because the minute you leave, it's like the door shuts behind you and maybe locks and you may not get back in. It's why I was actually cheered a little bit when I read an interview with Vince Gilligan, who's the showrunner for Breaking Bad. Because he worked on The X-Files in their later years. And he said that the worst comment he would ever get when he would tell people at parties, they go, what do you do? And he goes, I write for The X-Files. And he said people would always say, is that show still on? And he said that was the worst possible thing you could hear if you were working on The X-Files. People go, oh, I thought that was gone already.
I used to watch that.
Exactly. So he has said several times that there is a definite, finite, concrete endpoint for Breaking Bad. And that he has told people around him, he's like, you know, it's that whole thing of no matter how much I ask for those pills, don't give them to me. He's told people around him, even if I try to extend this, he's like, talk some sense into me. Don't let me extend the show past four or five seasons or whatever it is that he has in mind. I don't know how long he plans on making that show. But he said that he has an endpoint and he is going to do everything in his power to stick to it, which is great because because not enough shows do that. And especially Breaking Bad, which right now they're 3 for 3. And The Wire was the same thing. If they dragged The Wire off on their 5 seasons, nobody would talk about it as being a masterpiece.
I think as frustrating as it can be, I kind of appreciate the way the whole British model, where you have like 6 episodes, in what they call a series, which right. we call a season. And sometimes that's it. Also think of doing things like they did with Luther or some of these other things, or the Sherlock Holmes reboot for the BBC, right. where you do, like 3 2-hour things, and that's your entire output. That's it. And then maybe they go, everybody really loved it. It made a lot of money. Would you like to come back and do 3 more of those? And then you go, sure, in a year we'll do 3 more of those. But that's it. That's all there is. And I think that's admirable.
Well, they did it with The Office. The British Office, I think, went 2 seasons and the Christmas special. And I think that was it. And I think it actually, I forget now even what the conclusion of the British Office was. But I think it ended with, some other company absorbing them. And David Brent having that rare moment of like humanity where you felt sorry for him, where he was like, don't make me redundant, please.
Well, Patrick and I just watched the whole first series of Downton Abbey, which was on BBC like months ago. And they just ran it on Masterpiece. And depending on if you watched it on BBC, it was 6 parts. It was like 45 minutes each. Or it was like when they showed it on Masterpiece, they showed it in 90-minute segments. So they showed 2 at a time. So there were only like 4. And they just showed the last 2 this last week. And Patrick and I watched it. It was over. And Patrick's like, and at the end it says, a new series of Downton Abbey has been okayed for next year. And Patrick goes, what do you mean? What? It's over? How can it be over? I said, it's British, Pat. That's all you get. He's like, oh, damn it.
Well, I mean, when you watch a show like that, it seems absurd that American seasons, network television, right, go for 22 episodes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no wonder I'm like watching House and just going like, I don't know, I'm feeling a little bit of retread here because they're on 150 episodes by now. I mean, there's just no way. There is no way that any television series, no scripted series stays fresh for 150 episodes. Not even the stuff that's allegedly reality stays fresh that long.
Well, as much as I really love Lost, there were a lot of episodes where you're just going, wow, there's so much padding in the
yeah.
show. So much padding.
Where they're just, well, that's the thing where it's like they start big and they end big, right? It's like every season, like in House has developed this. They've got this down to an art. Where it's like the first 2 episodes of the season are really, really big and they set the stage for something, which they then forget about for 16 episodes. And then there's a huge, like, 3-part build-up to the finale in which everything changes and House is a new man for the next 2 episodes of, the first season. And then he forgets it again.
And everything in the middle is like, hey, somebody fell down and they had something mysterious and maybe it's lupus. I bet it's cancer. I don't think it is. Let's almost kill him. Oh, wait, I'm having an argument with my girlfriend and I just realized it's a tropical disease.
Wait a minute, I'm hearing Ryan Adams on the soundtrack. All right. Kelly Clark is on the phone. We'll talk to her in just about 12 seconds. Don't forget, coming up later on today, we get your Monkey Watch, Penis Watch, Corpse Watch, and Clue number 3. Coming if you're E.H. Vending, name that snack contest for this week. So that is all on the way. Let us now welcome to the Rick Emerson radio program from Willamette Week. The new issue on stands now. You can read it online at wweek.com. It is art and culture editor Kelly Clark. Hello, and how are you on this fine Wednesday?
I'm doing great. How are you two doing?
Well, my day is actually going pretty well. Dawn, I believe, had a bit of a morning, and I don't really know any further details. I just know that all I know is this, is that this morning getting ready to do Legion of News. It was like, 11:45, 11:50 or something, and I was just sitting here typing away, and Dawn got up, and you did like 3 things in a row. It was like you caught your hand in the headphone cable, you hit your knee or on the desk or something, and then you got ready to walk over to the printer, and your legs became entangled in the charging cable for your iPhone. And I saw that, and of course, as a fellow iPhone user, I said, "No, save the iPhone!" And you did, but too late did I say that. And it was a fellow, and you just looked at me, and you just said, "It's just one more thing in my morning," and sort of stomped off to the printer. So I don't know what it was that.
I had to drive by technology. Wow.
I had to drive Patrick to work. He had to be at work at 7:45, and I got up and I just got up in time to throw on clothes and get into the car and drive him the mile or two to work in the cold. And it was so cold, I decided to come back home and just get back into bed and warm up.
Right.
And I set the alarm on the phone and then I slept through it.
So then I got up.
I was like, ah,
crap,
I have to work fast. And so I'm working. Then it's like, oh, I'm going to go make my hair look pretty. So I go in the bathroom and I get this stuff that I use that works with the heat of the blow dryer, I guess, to straighten it out. And I sprayed it directly into my eye. So I'm standing there with this swollen red eye, blow drying my hair, and then thinking, why am I trying to make my hair look pretty when I have a giant swollen red eye?
Sexy.
And so I get all of that done, and I get my work done, and I get everything up, and I go through the thing, and the dog's going, give me a cookie. You always give me a cookie. And I'm like, okay, so I get the dog a cookie, and I do the thing. I walk out the door. I lock the door. I turn around. I take one step, and I get smacked in the face by a spider that is dangling on one thread exactly at face level right outside my front door like it was waiting for me.
And is it – but I mean, was it – it wasn't attached to the door. It was from the frame or something?
Yeah. It was a couple of feet away from the door. I locked the door, turned around, humpty-dum, on my way to work. Spider in the face.
That's my worst nightmare.
Then I got here, and then it was all the iPhone on the floor and smacking the thing and knocking the stuff around. I'm like, of course. It's just more.
Back on the just on the spider thing for just one moment. So you're opening the door. This is the front door to your apartment. And is it the thing where you're sort of backing out of the door because you got your coffee and you're saying goodbye to the dog and whatever?
Yeah, and then I lock the door. And then
you turn around.
I turn around like Dagwood Bumstead with my with my hat on and my briefcase.
And your one good eye.
And here I go with my one good eye. And then I just take two jaunty steps towards the parking lot and then whack, arachnid in the face.
Did you feel the spider or did you feel the web?
No, the scary thing is, with my one good eye, I actually saw it coming at me.
Filling your field of vision.
Just enough to terrify me then, just right before it smacked me in the face.
Did you end up beating yourself in the face to get it off you and therefore injuring your face even more?
Because then I, of course, dropped my briefcase and now I'm thinking, oh, great, I broke my laptop. And I'm going, get it off, like a spaz with my hands and hoping that none of my neighbors are watching because I think they already think that I'm insane anyway.
My final question here before we move on to the Willamette and all that stuff, because there's all kinds of stuff to get to today, including, by the way, in addition to the Neil Goldschmidt thing, there was apparently a convention of some kind that I missed. And I'm filled with self-loathing and regret over this because it's exactly the sort of thing that you and I should have gone to, Don. But my final question is, and I'm not saying this to freak you out, honestly, How did you verify that the spider wasn't on you somehow? Did you see him running away down the street?
I looked around and I made sure that he was gone. And then I thought about stepping on him just out of anger. And then I realized, he's outside. And
he was abiding by the boundaries.
No, he was in your space. He was in the walkway. Spiders need to know not to be in the walkway. That's the rule.
Yeah, but if I let him live, then perhaps he can like share with the other spiders that it's dangerous to be there. Where if I kill him, he cannot pass the message that the
thing. No, man, you have to teach your spiders that are in your area. Yeah. What is acceptable and not acceptable. By letting him live, you have just – the other spiders are going to walk all over you.
So now they think you're soft.
You're building their webs willy-nilly. It's just – it'll be anarchy.
But even though I knew he was gone and he wasn't on me, I got in the car and I still kept feeling all scrunchy like maybe there's another one. Maybe one snuck down my shirt when the other one was distracting me. Maybe it was a plot.
Do you ever – can I – let me just
– I'm such a ninny loser when it comes to spiders that you telling me this story – is going to make me incapable of feeling calm for the next 2 hours, and I'm going to think there's spiders crawling on me just from your story.
I'm glad you actually.
Because I'm such a loser.
I'm glad you said that because then I will not tell either of the spider unperson anecdotes that were queued up in my brain just now. I will skip those. I'll do those later on. So only Dawn is traumatized. That's how much Rick Emerson cares. So there's a huge thing going on right now. So the new Willamette is out, and there's this a profile of Neil Goldschmidt's sex abuse victim. And I somehow – I don't know where I was. Don, I'm talking about how we somehow were not aware of this part, that she actually died in January, which I think is a thing that we just missed altogether. I don't know how widely reported it was. I mean, we just didn't – I didn't realize that.
Well, you wouldn't have realized it because the obit that was published in the Oregonian didn't mention – the sex abuse, because they had made a deal with her not to name her name.
So that so that does explain
it. So when Elizabeth Lynn Dunham died in mid-January, the obit had no information on that. So you wouldn't have put two and two together.
All right,
but,
okay.
It was also a story that Nigel had been working on, and he had been speaking to her for many years and been going back and forth, and decided to write a story following up on what had happened in her life, and decided that it was the most appropriate to share her name with readers.
This is really a thing that you guys, I mean, well, Lamet has really owned this story, and just, you guys have been, as you said, tracking it, just following it for a long, long time. And so does the story, is this an overview of her life post the event, or the last few years, or?
Both. It really sort of confirms and sort of fleshes out some information. You know, it was always assumed that the abuse started when she was 14, and then we had heard rumors otherwise. Nigel Jaquess had heard rumors otherwise that it was even younger, and so he was able to confirm some information, some through interviews with her, corroborating evidence through her network of friends and things she had told other people. This affair, which that's what Goldschmidt likes to call it, is an affair. This abuse started when she was 13, and it lasted all the way through her 20s. So this is not something, this is not, he termed it as a one-year affair that he regretted, and it was actually a decade plus of sexual abuse.
And I mean, that'll, it goes without saying that just, that just throws such a warp into your personal development, when it happens at that age. And it is just, it is no wonder that so many sex abuse victims go off the rails in any
Absolutely.
Number of ways.
And she did. And, we've got people who have dated her in the past, people who were her close friends, some of her relatives, talking about this was an incredibly smart, incredibly gifted young woman who was so erratic. And Goldschmidt was part of her life and never stopped being part of her life. And they point to that as one of the reasons she was so erratic, had so many problems with drug abuse, with substance abuse, and why she ultimately died. It's pretty awful. I mean, and there's no two ways about it. It's awful, but it's one of those stories that we thought it was appropriate to tell and to not sugarcoat.
Is it? I don't even know if this is known. Is it assumed that her death was accidental, or is it unclear? Does it maybe seem as though?
As far as I know, it was just complications from drug abuse, and she also had chronic illness. So it wasn't a suicide.
A cumulative sort of effect.
A cumulative kind of thing. So we've got a full story that's about that, that kind of fleshes out what happened during her childhood, and then, with interviews with different people around town and different people in her life, talk about what she became, both good and bad. You know, the triumphs, she tried to get away and go to school in New York. She had a stint in a lawyer's office in Seattle that Goldschmidt set up for her, things that seemed to be working out, and then she would always sort of fall back and spiral back. And so it's definitely a more than an obit. It's kind of just taking a look at a woman who this never needed to happen to.
Cheryl was here yesterday, and we were talking about something or other, and I think we were actually, the subject of today came up when we were talking about this story, and I think Cheryl was the one who actually said, she said, is Neil Goldschmidt dead? And I said, no, I don't think so. And she noted that she sort of just had filed Neil Goldschmidt under the category of people who are dead because you never, ever, ever heard from him, that he just sort of seemed to be completely off the grid.
Is he not dead, but he actually, the Oregonian actually ran a story, which we found out just at the last moment. Margie Boulay actually wrote a story about the same subject about Elizabeth Lynn Dunham, but did not name her, and it came out on Tuesday. So this story was up on our website on Monday, and Margie posted her story on Tuesday. And she has a reaction from Goldschmidt, which basically is the same thing he was saying a couple years ago when Nigel wrote about, which is he's deeply saddened that he had this effect on this woman's life, and he regretted the affair. So he's sticking to what he said. He's not only dead, but he talked to the Oregonian about it. Obviously, he did not talk to us about it. We asked for a comment, and we did not get one.
Seriously, you know,
not surprised by.
You know, there's a whole lot of people in this world that just ought to be horsewhipped. I mean, really. I mean, for openers. There's no way to gracefully transition from that to anything else. But you know, it is. But as you said, it's a huge story. Not just in the impact that it had. The way that it reverberated out, but also it is, you know, a person's life by dint of one incident that then spiraled into a pattern of incidents that then derailed everything. And it just is a microcosm of, you know, it's just.
Yeah, the only good thing that could come out of this is to know that, you know, we have already started to get heat about naming her name and from people who think it's not appropriate to name abuses of sexual abuse, but we've also gotten letter after letter from readers who are saying, thank you for naming her. This is my name. This is what happened to me. This is something that needs to be out there. She shouldn't have been gagged. Goldschmidt struck a deal with her in her 20s that in exchange for her never talking about this sex abuse, he gave her $1,500 a month, and that continued, it continued for many, many years. And so to be able to say her name and to have readers respond and say, yes, this is what needs to happen. She had nothing to be ashamed of. He did. That's a big deal. And there's some people who are going to think it's wholly appropriate, inappropriate, and that it's not acceptable, and that it's doing her more harm. But the position that our newspaper took, and we talked about it beforehand, the staff was made aware of it and asked how they felt about it, and we felt that it was important that she have a name and not just be his victim, because the only thing you heard for years is Goldschmidt's victim. It's like,
that's the thing, is that and I understand why these policies are in place to some degree, but when they are just people are just described as the victim, or the boy who was in his teens, or the girl who was 15, mm-hmm. it just makes them these amorphous figures that don't bear any relation to real people. And what that does, and I'm not saying that this is ever done with malicious intent, it's the opposite, but what it does is it dehumanizes them in a way that renders the rest of society, I think, less able to view this as a thing that actually can be happening to anybody. Yes. And to the people next door.
Yeah. This is a flesh and blood woman, and we have pictures in here of her as a young adult, as a young woman in high school. This is a person. You can't get away from it anymore. So that's, usually we talk about lots of fun things when I come on. I'm bored. But, obviously that's the story that we're the most passionate about this week. But, there's tons of other stuff. As you said, there was far more lighthearted things going on as well, including the Pacific Northwest Organizing Expo.
Okay, this is the thing I did want to ask about, because I saw this and I somehow missed this altogether. And so the Pacific Northwest Organizing Expo, which you hear that name and you're like, well, what is that all about? But it is just a thing where they just sell, market, display, and demonstrate organizational and like OCD, friendly items. So everything in your life, a place for everything and everything in its place, right? Am I on the money there?
It's exactly what it was. And we sent one of our writers who, to put it mildly, is sort of, he's a slob. I mean, he looks like a slob. His house is a slob. And he found out about this, and he's like, you must send me to this. This might be my only chance to get organized. And so he reported back from this expo. And really, the conclusion he came to was, this is terrifying, and that I want to stay a slob.
Now, is this like a Franklin Covey meets Storables kind of convention, just for people that want to have?
Yeah, actually, the image that we have with the story is like a crowd of women who are sort of flocking to this booth with this giant banner that says Storables. So you're dead on. And he said that every single presenter was a woman, and he wasn't going to try to draw any conclusions from that. But this was definitely, there was a lot of ladies at this event. The kind of things that they were selling, I'm just reading it off. Baskets filled with desk organizers, both rubber and leather, file folders, in-baskets, gear ties, cable ties, mobile phone holders, weekly grid pads, magnetic calendar pads. And then,
I think Rick's a little aroused right now.
I really am.
Oh,
this
I know.
Is becoming two messages.
See, that's what happened when I read this as well. I was like, my God, I think I would have really enjoyed this.
We have a cottage industry in this country of places that sell you things to put inside of other things, or things to hold other objects that you own.
Yeah.
So I'm unashamed of that.
Well, I love the fact because it's not only that, but then there were sort of like these life coaches that would try to give you sort of a way to think about, like a big metaphor to think about your life that would help you. Like, he's talking about this one woman who explained that large life goals were rocks filled in a container and trivial activities were grains of sand. And our space was taken up with sand and not rocks.
That is,
I mean,
here's because I am that guy. Not only do I know that metaphor, but I actually know where that's from. So the rocks and the sand, that is a Stephen Covey teaching. So Stephen Covey of Franklin Covey actually created and I believe has trademarked the rocks and the sand as a metaphor for organizational skills. So really, if I'd known about this, it would have been your slob from the Willamette and then me.
He said it was hilarious, and you know, it's just kind of it's a really fun piece that's in there. It kind of tells you all about what happened and sort of his reaction to it, which is he literally was struck tongue-tied because he said he didn't even have the vocabulary to talk to these women. He didn't even know how to speak their language. So he just basically smiled and nodded and sipped his coffee and ate his scone, his free scone. And then, like, let them, and he brought them pictures of, like, his closet, and they were aghast, and, you know, just tried to figure out, and he said he was so happy to meet them, and he was proud, but he thought he was going to have to stay a slob, because he just thought sort of the rigidity of packing your life into these little boxes actually made life more scary. It made life scarier, not less scary. So
I will say this, that this is why I know that this is the place for me. If this is an annual event that comes back to town, Rick Emerson's going to be there because, and Dawn, I think I've told you about this, but I don't know if it was actually on the air. For Christmas, among the items that my wife got me, she got me what she called an OCD care pack. And it was, first of all, she found the best legal tablets that I have ever used in my life. They've got a really, really strong, thick cardboard backing so that it's almost like having a clipboard carried with you everywhere. Also, there's a cover on the legal pad to keep the papers underneath from wrinkling or scuffing. And then on the inside, the papers can not only be detached because they are pre-perforated at the top, but each sheet then also has holes punched in it already so that they can be bound so your notes can go into a three-ring binder at home. This was accompanied by not one, but in fact two boxes of my Pilot V5 Precise RT black pen, which is the only pen that I will write anything with. Then a third box, which was a sampling of similar pens that she felt I might enjoy for sort of ancillary or secondary, tertiary note-taking. So there you go.
That is a good woman right there.
That, as Dawn said, that is love. That really is romance.
Yeah, I used to be a Uniball girl, but now I've actually changed just straight up to fine tip Sharpie.
Now, when you say the fine tip Sharpie, are you talking about the Sharpie marker or the actual pen? Because Sharpie now makes an actual pen.
No, Sharpie fine tip marker.
All right, good for you. See, and the thing about that says that you are a woman of action and you don't look back. You're not writing things in pencil. Your life is in black marker and it's irrevocable.
I love the Sharpie fine point marker, and I use it all the time because I like the way my handwriting looks in it, and I know it's not going to smear in this game, but it drives me a little bit crazy that it soaks through to the page below.
Tomorrow I'm going
to... That it does. Well, you have to use the proper memo pad for it that has thick enough pages to stand up to the fine tip marker. Wow. I think I just created a pet name for my pens.
Tomorrow I will bring in the Sharpie. It is basically Sharpie's attempt to replicate this Pilot pen. It is an actual, it's not a ballpoint, but it's, you know, whatever this is, where it's got the little nib or whatever, the little quill, the metal quill at the end. Mm-hmm. So it is Sharpie's attempt to make a clickable ink pen. I'll bring it in. I think you might like it, Dawn Taylor.
Well, thank you.
Wow, this has been the weirdest conversation ever. The new issue is on stands now. You can read it in print.
Yeah.
Willamette Week or online at wweek.com. And at some point, I'm going to drop you an email. I wasn't really aware of whether I could relay the tone or contents of the email exchange we had last night this morning. Because I don't know what's.
That's common knowledge now. You can go for it.
Okay, so I'll probably tell that story maybe later on today or the next time we speak with you. So
I think that's great. And I actually went and found the lyrics, and I don't know how to feel about it, but I think I'm okay with it considering who I am.
Well,
I think it's a good thing.
Well, now I guess I have no choice but to say so. Just real quickly, so people don't feel like they're out of the loop. So, so it is, I guess, now public knowledge that Kelly Clark is, you, as they used to say on 50 sitcoms, you are with child.
I am with child. I am very undoubtedly with child. If not, then. And there is something wrong with me.
Well, and it's that thing where they always say, like, well, you know, and you wait X number of weeks before you tell people or whatever, and, you know, and so you wait until, and then I said, well, you know, I'll kind of just keep it under my hat until it's sort of known. And then, you know, and then you were here, I guess, earlier this week or late last week to be on with Greg and Sarah, and it was, you know, it became, you know, it's like, you look at this room, you go, this is a woman who's pregnant. And I thought, it's got to be known by now. I mean, clearly this is not a thing that you can just, you know, it's not like the cut of the shirt or something. So I said, you know, well, you know, that's great. And congratulations. And, you know, is it a boy or a girl or whatever? And you said that it was a girl and you guys had picked out the name Alex.
Yep.
And you noted that was, you know, not necessarily a strange name, but maybe an unorthodox name in some circles for a girl. And I observed that there was a song by the Caulfields called Alex Again, which was about a girl who was named Alex and whatever. And we had this conversation and you just said sort of passingly, you're like, well, send it to me. You know, just send me the song. And I went, oh, great, no problem. And I'm a guy who hears melody first and lyrics like a distant last. And so I was getting ready to send you the song last night. And then I thought, you know, I wonder what the lyrics of this song actually say. It's been a while since I've heard it. Let me bring it up. And Alex, of course, is like a quasi-evil seductress who has a sort of strangely, I don't know if the word is edible, but she has a strangely close, maybe not improper, but strangely close relationship with her father, who I think she then kills at the end of the song.
Yeah, it's iffy. It's definitely iffy.
And I just thought, you know, no. And so I sent you an email last night saying, hey, just FYI, this is all awkward. So I'm never going to send you that song. So don't think that I forgot about it. It's just never going to happen by now. And so I guess you're actually okay. So I'll forward the file along later on today.
Yeah, all I remember is that there's a lyric in it that says, Alex never met a man's mouth she couldn't make scream her name.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Which, you know, that's what I want for my future daughter is, you know, I think what I wrote back to you was, considering who I am and given the type of things that I enjoy, there are far worse things that my daughter could turn out to be than an evil seductress.
All right, then. Well, so, my conscience is
I'm not
is
planning
clear.
That for her. Like, I would maybe, you know, she could play soccer or go to, like, maybe
awesome.
Dance class. Let's start with that.
Excellent.
But no, I would enjoy collecting like quasi obscene songs.
Well, I'll pass along. You can keep it under lock and key until she's of the proper age, and then you can decide whether or not to let her hear it. All right.
Well, the reason I think that this is probably okay is because I wanted the name Alex, and Dave, my husband, likes it too, so he was cool with it. And somebody asked me where it came from. I was like, I don't know. I always just liked that name when I was a kid. Like, I didn't like my name. I liked Alex. And they were like, okay. And now we realize my mother has come up with the fact that the reason I like the name Alex is not only because of Alex D. Keaton from Family Ties, but also because of Alex, the welder / stripper from Flashdance.
That is
who
awesome.
I was obsessed with as a child.
So really, in a roundabout
way,
Joe Esterhaas named your baby.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent.
Which I can't tell you how embarrassing that is. I mean, to realize that as soon as they said this, I felt like I felt her kick, and I was like, obviously, I mean, like, it was a response like, yes, you douche, this is what you did. You Excellent. Named your baby after Flashdance.
I think by embarrassing you mean fantastic. That's really what you're trying to say.
Oh, what are the other of those? Yeah, one of those adjectives would work just fine.
Well, congratulations to you and to David. And so we look forward to seeing you soon. Have a fantastic day, Kelly.
Thank you.
All right, there you go. That's Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. All right, there you go. Well, so now that conversation is done. It was all very awkward. And as you noted, I think at the beginning of the show, that any number of awkward moments. You know, if you look at the Rick Emerson, Kelly Clark trajectory, just step back and look at our flight pattern like some sort of an air traffic controller, it's just nothing but a series of awkward moments, all of them my fault. So,
yeah.
You know, what are you going to do? All right. How are you, Dawn?
I'm quite fine.
Would you
I'm
like to hear good. One of the spider anecdotes?
Sure.
You don't have to. You could pass.
You know, I'm not really that squeamish about spiders, so sure. I will hear the spider.
Do you want to hear the one
it
that...
It doesn't involve eyeballs, does it?
No, no.
Okay.
Do you want to hear the one that actually happened to me or the one that I observed?
Which is more alarming.
Well, the one that happened to me, so I mean, it's more alarming to me. But the other one, I'll just say this. I will just say that this years ago, when I was in my late teens or something, and I used to... I had this this part-time radio gig in, I think, like Prosser or someplace, some horrible town. And so I would, and it was just off in the boondocks. It was just off of the sticks and basically in the middle of a dried up field of weeds. And I would go to this dirty old radio station and play Statler Brothers records and weep. And then, you know, and just think to myself, I could, you know, but it, I guess maybe at that point, young enough that that it didn't seem like a warning sign that I was choosing poorly in terms of career. So I would just be off, and it was like this filthy, literally it was in a trailer. It was in like a double wide sort of a thing that had been turned into a radio station in the middle of a weed field. It was just, anyway, but it was, you know, dusty and, you know, and this, and it was like you'd tumbleweeds everywhere, and you'd walk out and it was, you know, you'd have to like pick the sagebrush off you as you would get in the car. And so I was there one night working, get done, get in the car, get all the way home, and I walk into the house, and I forget, it was like walking down the hall, as I still lived at home, I was walking down the hall, going to my bedroom, going to the bathroom or something, and there's a mirror in our hallway, or was, directly across from my bedroom, and I walked by, and it was just that sort of, I don't even remember, I can't remember why now I actually turned to look at the mirror. Like maybe it was like I had something in my eye or just I felt something strange. But I look in the mirror and there was just a huge spider sitting on top of my head.
Oh.
Like right there. Just sort of crawling around a little bit. And it's like I had, I think I was either wearing a hat or it's like I just had, I had thick, lustrous, mullety hair. Maybe so I didn't feel it like, I didn't feel those little spider feet tapping on my skull. And so its presence was unknown to me. And I just look and I went, okay, well, I guess, you know, I'll see why my left eye is itchy or whatever reason I was looking into the, you know, see what new pustules have formed on my teenage face. I just turned to look into the mirror and it was really like, you know, in Fatal Attraction or something when she closes the mirror and like there's, you know, Alex lurking in the background, you know, and I just looked in the mirror and I went, okay, that's a, you know, and, you see the, and then what do? You immediately go like, do, like you're putting out a fire and you're patting, you know, slapping your head with your hands. But of course, that has the effect, you never hit the spider. That always has the effect of just knocking the spider onto the ground where he can then go for a knife or something. And then it's like, then it's the thing of you and the face hugger and aliens. And you're in the med lab room with Newt trying to figure out exactly where the thing is and waiting for it to swing out of the medicine cabinet at you later. It's totally horrifying.
I've never had anything like that with a spider, but I was in Mexico with my mother once, and we were in Cuernavaca, and we were staying in this hotel that had originally been this home that, like, King Ferdinand had built for his mistress, and apparently there was a secret passageway between the palace and, like, her house, and it was one of those great great Spanish/Mexican kind of buildings where it was built in, like, sort of a U-shape around an open courtyard. And then what was originally the living room had this big fireplace. And the wall opened up so that, you know, you could enjoy the night air and look at the gardens while you're sitting indoors. And, of course, that means all the bugs can come in. But we were sitting there and having a nice rum drink. And it was off-season, so there wasn't anyone else, like, in the place except my mother and I and the people who worked there. And I'm sitting there having my rum drink and felt something just smack me in the forehead really hard. And I reached up, you know, as one does when something like that happens, and just went whap with my hand to brush whatever it was off, landed on the table in front of me, and it was a cockroach about 3 inches long. It was huge. It was one of those great big giant brown ones that fly around and live outside. And I yelped like, you know, so I'd been burnt with acid and leapt up and went, gah, you know, and it was there. And the guys who worked there came running over and they're like, como, como. And I pointed at the thing on the table, which, of course, it's gone now because
right,
yeah. It ran away. But I'll just, and then I speak very little, like to almost no Spanish. So I just looked at the guys and went, cucaracha. This big! And I hold my hands about 2 feet away from each other, and they all just looked at me and started laughing uproariously at the hilarious American tourist.
Because that's the thing that they either believe one of two things. Either A, that you are overstating the size of the cucaracha, or that you're not, but like they've seen it a jillion times. It didn't really bother them. It didn't faze them. Wow.
But I didn't have the words to go, and it hit me in the head.
God damn.
It flew into my head.
Because the friend of mine lived in Venezuela for a while when he was a kid. In fact, it was I believe it was the same kid who had my childhood friends kind of get, they morph into one another occasion, but I think it was the same kid whose dad traveled and had the bootleg Star Wars things. But they lived in Venezuela for a while, and they had in their garage a jar in which they had caught and, like, you know, preserved or whatever, like one like a huge Venezuelan cockroach, which is just, I mean, they're massive.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just huge. That's why, even though it's terrifying, it's not surprising when they find those like potato bugs on the bottom of the ocean floor that are 9 feet across. Because you get the feeling that anything you've seen on Earth exists in all imaginable sizes in one place or another.
Yeah, and everything we have here, they have it like five times that size in South America.
Exactly.
Which is why I will never go there.
All right. Jesus. All right. Well, we should take a break. Still to come, we got your Monkey Watch, Penis Watch, Corpse Watch, and clue number three for this week's Name That Snack Contest. I'll go ahead and play this because we were just referencing it from the album Whirly Gig, now sadly out of print and unavailable. This is the Caulfields and Alex again, which we were just discussing with Ms. Kelly Clark. On the other side, we got the news with Don Taylor and such like. Stay there. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Don't go anywhere. There's a whole thing happening there where the actual sound isn't coming out. Let me just see if I can try that again with the whole and the whatnot. No. No. No, actually, nothing's happening there.
So you're going to edit all this out later?
No, not so much. Oh, you know why?
Yeah.
Volume turned off. Hey, now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Situation. Waited 7 years with great expectations. If they had a crown, they'd hold a daily coronation for Alex again. Alex again. Well, every now and then she looks just like the girl I knew from way back when. She's got the souls of 50 men, neatly filed for future use. If she ever needs to make an example of them, another will to crush your spirit to tame. Up against the wall, they all look the same, but Alex never met a mouth. She couldn't make scream out her name. Alex again. Alex again. Short of breath, no one is quite sure if he had a stroke or had his ego stroked to death. Alex sits alone by the picture window, looking more and more like the Mona Lisa. Never gives away everything she might know, but something sure has pleased her. It's Alex again. It's Alex again.
here in Hell's Hammer, just thinking of Deviltry Planet. Why panic's a hat that's so old? I'd rather write about her in my diary. Could she be mine without selling a soul? Dirty deeds from a demon seed don't excite me anymore. Is there one girl, just one girl who says I'm bigger than Jesus now? And I love her, I'm bigger than Jesus now. Up above her, I'm stage diving up the church of the holier than thou. Oh, I'm bigger than Jesus now. Got his uptight white virginal followers. I've got these metal chicks dumber than rocks. Dated one once, but I hated the music. And all her ex-boyfriends were there on the bus. It's never good to be understood by a girl in acid wash. God only knows what it is that I really want. Guess I could ask, but he's not the best confidant. Puts me down in the biblical sense. In this basement apartment with hell to pay rent. But there's one girl, just one girl, who says I'm bigger than Jesus now. And I love her, I'm bigger than Jesus now. Up above her, I'm stage diving up the church of the holier than thou. Now I'm bigger than Jesus
to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Honestly, this is, well, I guess I want to identify. Someone says, about the Oregonian, it's true. It was nearly impossible to get fired from there. Unless you're the guy who was caught selling cocaine in the freight elevator.
It's good to have standards.
But that's fascinating because it makes me wonder, okay, well, was there a guy who was caught selling cocaine in the freight elevator? And if so, is this that person who's emailing me right now?
Oh.
Or did they know
who
it was?
See, I don't doubt the first part, but yeah, I'm curious if that's that guy did.
It's interesting that the freight elevator is the place where that, is the freight elevator like the, I don't know, like the third floor washroom at Macy's or something? Like if something, you know, something illicit needs to be done, that's where you go. So I'm told.
Yeah.
We've reached that point in the discussion where you've just decided to sing along and just to leave me to my own devices.
Yes.
By the way, we get another email that says, Dearest Dawn. Okay, once again, Dawn, you started the donut hole story, but then Rick did his usual interruption and you moved to the next story before you finished. Then in all caps, finish the donut story! I wasn't aware that we even had a donut story today.
No, it was yesterday. It was Legion of News. It was the...
Today?
Yeah.
Nah, I don't remember a donut story.
Yeah, well, we'll have to do it tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah, whatever you say. Today's Rick Emerson radio program brought to you by, among other folks, Squires Electric. Find out more about them by going to squireselectric.com. squireselectric.com. It is 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. 1609. To go back to the Seamus thing for just one moment, you know, people say, well, look, you know, I am kind of handy around the house. I do understand how electricity works. I've done this sort of thing before. You know, maybe I just handle all that myself. Sometimes you can do that. You know, maybe if you are a guy who really has a handle on those things, you can get the, you know, the socket fixed. You can get the outlet taken care of. But, you know, if it's one of those things such as, you know, I don't know, your house is covered in 75 feet of snow in Colorado, you probably don't want to be handling that all yourself anyway. You want to get a team of guys out there because you got more guys, it gets done faster. More efficiency means, you know, the job is handled quickly, it's handled correctly, it's handled, you know, right the first time out. And it's not just going to be you with a flashlight in your teeth and a pair of needle-nose pliers in your hand and then a screwdriver in the other hand jabbing at a thing trying to fix it all yourself. If you understand how electricity works, so much the better, because you're going to be able to tell them exactly what you need done and exactly how it's got to be taken care of. But they'll come out and they'll get it taken care of for you, because, again, it's a whole platoon, whole crew of guys coming out from Squires Electric, all of them good folk, and they will get it taken care of properly and quickly. It means you're going to be on the road to Wellville electrical-wise, so it's, everything's going to be taken care of. You got some sort of a glitch, some sort of a problem happening, if you got an inspection coming up, everything is going to be resolved sooner rather than later. And, you know, if you don't understand how electricity works, I mean, beyond the whole lights on, lights off thing, then they're going to be able to figure it out. They're going to diagnose the problem, get you an estimate right up front, and you know, get you on the path to having everything taken care of, and you're going to know up front about what it's going to cost you. 503-252-1609 is how you contact them. 503-252-1609 or SquiresElectric.com. That is SquiresElectric.com. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier. Squires Electric.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for coming along. It is 503-505-6964. Still to come, Monkey Watch, Penis Watch, Corpse Watch on the way, and clue number three for the E.H. Vending Name That Snack Contest. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Well, Rick, you know what day it is today?
I don't know.
Groundhog Day.
Okay.
This
Here's
is
the thing, is I wasn't just playing dumb right there. When you said, do you know what day it is, I had already forgotten. We talked about this in Legion of News, and then I just...
Isn't it? A little bit that you forgot it was Groundhog Day?
Yes, because I was what did I say?
So now we're going to do the story over again about Groundhog Day.
Oh, see, now we went two different ways there. Yeah. I was thinking it was ironic because I was actually kvetching. There's no other word for it. I was kvetching in Legion of News. I was saying, like, why do we have to talk about this? Everybody knows it's Groundhog Day. Everybody knows the deal. Everybody understands it. No one needs to be reminded about Groundhog Day. And then just now you said, you know what day it is? And I went, no, because I just...
Apparently, you do need to be reminded that it's Groundhog Day.
Completely slipped out of my head.
That All explains right. why you did not bring me a Groundhog's Day present.
I get your Groundhog's Day present.
So the tradition was inherited from German immigrants who monitored groundhogs' behavior to make decisions about when their fields should be planted. If the groundhog comes out today, and they always do it now in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, and if Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog, comes out and
I hate you.
He doesn't see his shadow... then he comes out of his burrow and ends his hibernation, which means that spring is coming.
Okay.
If he does see his shadow, then that means that that winter will continue.
Let me ask you this.
Okay.
Here's the thing about Punxsutawney Phil. Mm-hmm. First of all, no. Third of all, Gobbler's Knob. What is up with that? Why would you name a place Gobbler's Knob? Please to explain.
I'm not sure. Is it really called Gobbler's Knob in real life? I know Punxsutawney is an actual place in Pennsylvania. Obviously.
Gobbler's Knob is a real place.
Is it really?
Well, I mean, look, I haven't been there, but I mean, the new. And when I say the news media reported it, must be true. I know that sounds dumb, but I mean, it's. But I mean, why would they all just say that if it wasn't really a place? And who would have ever just come
okay,
up?
Well.
I mean, it's not like the city fathers a few years ago would have gone, we need a place to, we need to class up the joint a little bit. Let's give it a fake name, Gobbler's Knob.
As far as I knew up until this moment, that was just that was just something they made up for the movie.
Oh, no, that's a real place. In fact, I think one of the news cuts you've got, did I give you the Groundhog Day news?
No, you did not.
I've got some additional Groundhog Day news.
And yet you still forgot.
Yeah. Yes, well,
after you went and got this and printed it out for me.
I think it's part of my brain is trying to spare the rest of me from having to hear the story ever again. Here we go. Let's see. Gobbler's Knob. Phil emerges from his temporary home on Gobbler's Knob, located in a rural area 2 miles east of Punxsutawney. So Gobbler's Knob is, in fact, well, that's like one of those, you know, where do you live? Blue Balls, Connecticut, you know, or just you're some, you know, some whatever. I mean, look, we have an intersection of hate and failing here. So it's not like we're really in a position to make fun of what other people name things.
Maybe it's named that way because they had turkeys there.
Possibly.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, they have a family fun park, by the way.
Really? Okay, hold on.
You have to plug in
your computer because we have to hear whatever that is.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and, if you want to just plug that in.
Hold on.
This is a family fun park in Punxsutawney?
This is Gobbler's Knob. So hold on, let me...
By the way, this person wants it known. No, I am not the guy who sold cocaine in the freight elevator. I did used to work at the Oregonian, but I did not sell cocaine in the freight elevator or anywhere else. All right.
Pavilion and okay, here, let me start this over
the Gobbler's
so you
Knob
can hear
Family
from
Fun Park thing.
At Gobbler's Knob Family Fun Park, featuring a lighted driving range, miniature golf with snack bar, arcade game area, ice cream parlor, special event party room, pavilion, and DST's 9-hole par 3 golf course, where club rentals and golf balls are for sale. Gobbler's Knob Family Fun Park, exit 22 off I-88, Route 145 east of Cobleskill. Open Sunday through Thursday, 10 to 9, Friday and Saturday, 10 to 10. Weather permitting, gobblersknob.us.
Yeah.
Okay. So there you go.
So there's that.
Gobbler's Knob Family Fun Park.
Yeah. All right.
That sounds wrong.
How does it? So that was question number three. Question number one was, first of all, and somebody has actually emailed the same question. Says, how does it work? Does the groundhog give a thumbs up? I mean, how do you know? Even like, and I understand that it's all just like a bunch of nonsense. But even in the world, like in the in-universe logic here, how does the groundhog denote having seen the shadow? How is that
Well, ostensibly,
indicated?
He sees the shadow and it like startles him. And he scurries back in?
He
goes back in. And if he does not see a shadow, then he's not startled and he comes out.
Here's the thing. And I know this sounds like another thing where I'm just getting my information about life from movies. But I am to understand, because Harold Ramis says this on the commentary for Groundhog Day, that they went out of their way to depict the ceremony accurately as it is actually conducted. Mm-hmm. And Brian Doyle Murray actually picks the groundhog and listens to him. The groundhog whispers into his ear. He goes, "What's that? Oh, okay." And then he puts the thing down. And he goes, you know, the blah, 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 prognosticator, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, you know, has seen his shadow.
Yeah, and the master of ceremonies or whatever he is for the Punxsutawney thing wears a big top hat like Brian Doyle Murray did in the movie. And yeah, and a band plays and all kinds of stuff happens.
And then also, it makes you wonder. So, I mean, it came from Germany, so God only knows. I mean, you know, they invented, you know, methamphetamine. So I really, anything from that country is sort of not a shock. But how is it that you ever would have come up with this? What a strange, bizarre, random superstition. You know, like even when it comes to nature superstitions, this is sort of weird.
Yeah, well, yeah, superstitions in and of themselves are odd.
I mean, I get that. It's like, genesis of it.
It comes from, well, like I said, it came from farmers trying to figure out ways that they could predict whether, you know, whether it was safe to plant yet or not. And ostensibly, that's twice I've used ostensibly. I should stop saying that. But apparently it's one of the things that... Before we had like the Farmer's Almanac and ways of measuring the length of days
before
and what
we
weather
had the
was.
Farmer's Almanac.
Well, it.
I know. I'm just. It makes you sound like you're like 170 years old.
Whether or not the groundhog could see his shadow was an indication of where the sun was in the sky and you know, how far into the seasons and stuff they actually were.
Well, and it is true that animals have a keener sense. This is not a fake science. Animals do have a keener sense for things that are happening in nature than we do because they have a different set of senses.
Yeah.
For like the whole thing of animals sensing earthquakes is not a myth. That is actually the rest of nature farm animals before land mass shifts is well documented. So I guess it is not like outside the realm of possibility. I mean, they can smell
essentially It makes him a furry sundial,
yeah.
More than anything else, really.
Well, but it might also be this. It's not even that they see where the sun is. Again, yeah. if it's
sunny at all. If it's sunny, then that means winter's almost over.
Or it could also be this. It just could be, again, you know, like if you get like a cat that can smell cancer or whatever that cat is that in that lab in Britain, then it could also be that the animal, the groundhog, isn't. that the groundhog, now I'm just doing the thing, I'm trying to figure out why Chopin saw spots everywhere he looked, that the groundhog isn't seeing the sun as such, that the groundhog, if you put any sort of credence to this, that the groundhog is in fact detecting some other change in the earth that is a result of the sun. So the groundhog would be maybe smelling, it would be the scent of like a chemical change in the ground, or the groundhog would be detecting a certain amount of moisture or lack of moisture in the air that is in turn dependent upon how sunny it is.
Well, today, go away. Somebody's calling me probably to tell me about Groundhog Day.
Really? Is somebody calling you to tell you about Groundhog Day?
No.
Because I was going to tell you to answer the phone.
It is Candlemas, which, according to Germans, is, you know, Groundhog Day. And the idea is that if it's sunny enough that he sees his shadow, then he I'm not sure if it's – yeah, if it's cloudy, then that means the weather's going to be moderate. I guess this is in Germany. German weather is different from ours. How does that work?
Oh.
But anyway, if it's cloudy, he says, "Oh, weather's nice. I'll come out." If it's sunny enough that he sees a shadow, he goes back in and sleeps for another like 6 weeks or something.
Well, how does that work?
I'm not sure.
You would think more sun means less winter.
Well, in Scotland.
Oh God, why did I even mention this?
The tradition may derive from an English poem that goes, "As the light grows longer, the cold grows stronger. If Candlemas be fair and bright, winter will have another flight. If Candlemas be cloud and rain, winter will be gone and not come again. A farmer should on Candlemas Day have half his corn and half his hay. On Candlemas Day, if thorns hang a drop, you can be sure of a good pea crop."
Someone says, it comes from Germany, so let's just consider ourselves lucky it doesn't involve pooping on the groundhog somehow.
There's also a whole thing about the Georgian calendar and the equinox and stuff, but we don't really care. Anyway, Mike Johnson with the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club. Punxsutawney Groundhog Club is hard to say. He says that this means that we will have an early spring.
The sky is clear. Prepare yourself for warmth.
Except that I thought it was the opposite.
I know.
It's cloudy means that he doesn't. Wait, no.
I'm not even going to ask. I'm just going to swallow whatever he says.
Anyway, here he is reading from the official proclamation.
The thing about this guy, whatever his name, Mike Johnson, he's broken my will.
Is this a guy in the top hat?
Yes. Okay. I think who apparently is the mayor of Punxsutawney.
Yeah.
He surveyed his surroundings.
All right, hold on. I just feel like I'm becoming Bill Murray's character. I'm just surrounded by hicks everywhere. Okay, hold on. Okay.
He surveyed his surroundings carefully and found that there was no shadow around. So an early spring it will be!
Woo! Crowds gathered to watch the annual event at Gobbler's Knob.
Bill!
I wonder if you're the reporter gathering sound for this. You have some sort of like how many fills you need the crowd to chant before you consider it an adequate man on the street soundbite. How long does the piece really have to be? You know, they got to say fill at least 12 times. Okay. It says maybe it's just presumed that if we humans can see the groundhog's shadow, the groundhog can also see his shadow. He's probably not sniffing it out like impending death. We're probably making too much of this whole thing. Thank you. Appreciate that. Thanks so much.
Proponents of Groundhog Day, by the way, say that
Proponents of Groundhog Day.
That his forecasts are accurate 75 to 90% of the time.
Uh-huh. Is that like a lobbying group in Washington, D.C.?
Okay. A Canadian study, however, for 13 cities in the past 30 to 40 years puts the success rate closer to 37%. Which would be less than half, which means that he's not even 50. It's not even a 50-50 toss. It's that the groundhog is actually wrong more than he's right.
Yeah. Well, everything is like that, though. I mean, that's the, you know, doesn't matter. By the way, somebody says, what was the name of the Punxsutawney play? Gobbler's Fun Hole or something? What the hell was it called, the place?
Isn't that the name of our swing club here in town? It's like Gobbler's Fun Hole.
Now people are just sending me... you have another show to do this afternoon. Stop it. You're going to make me lose control. Now, people, my decorum will be, you won't be able to keep my composure. Now people are just sending me the websites for awkwardly named family fun parks and resorts, such as this place in the UK called Sandy Balls. In the heart of the forest, I'm sorry, in the heart of the New Forest, the website says, Sandy Balls is the perfect destination to have time getting away from it all. And then at the and at the top, there's a series of, you know, where you can either like about and fac and resort. Things to do at Sandy Balls. Right next to that one, discover Sandy Balls. That's excellent. Browse Sandy Balls. I'll send this to you just so you can amuse yourself with it later on. All right. That's
when I get home, by the way, I'm registering Gobbler's Fun Hole as a as a domain name.
Keep in touch via the Sandy Balls newsletter. Oh, my God. All right. I don't even know what we're doing.
Let's do a penis watch.
Okay. Seems redundant, but all right. Here's your penis watch.
Take a look at my enormous penis. And my troubles start a-melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis. And everything is going my way.
Here's Don Taylor with your penis watch.
Okay. Massachusetts man, and I'm just guessing at that because I forgot, I once again lost the thing here. A Newton, Massachusetts man was charged with indecent exposure Saturday after he decided to show a convenience store clerk his wares.
He decided.
Yes, he decided.
His wares.
He walked into the Wilco Hess gas station just before 11 p.m. and paid for his gasoline, according to the police report. He returned a few minutes later with the zipper on his pants down, purchased another beer, and left. He then returned a third time with his penis out and bought a lighter. The clerk called the police and reported what happened, giving them a description of the man's car. A short time later, a Jeep Cherokee matching the guy's description was stopped.
So it was like an escalating thing. Like first he came in normally, then he came in with a zipper down, then he came in zipper down, tackle out.
Right.
So was he just going to keep going until they noticed? Was he going to set his pants on fire or something? Was he going to like attach sparklers to his penis after that? Or just sort of wave it around like a pocket watch on a fob?
Well, he left after that, so I'm thinking it's a three times the charm thing. I'm wondering if he then was going to go to another store and do the same thing, like, you know.
Maybe the ritual itself is part of the gratification.
You know, buy something, leave, come back with the zipper down, buy one thing, leave, come back, penis out.
I wonder if he's developed like a sort of a science about like, I mean, is there any, what was the first item he bought?
The first thing he bought gas, because it was a gas station or a convenience store, bought gas, paid for his gas station, left, came back a few minutes later with the zipper down, bought a beer, then returned a third time with his penis out and bought a lighter.
It's strange that whoever was behind the counter, the man or the woman, noticed that his zipper was down the second time, because sometimes you don't really notice that. In other words, I'm just surprised that the first two stages. Well, I guess if he returned, though, you'd notice him more because the guy was just there.
And so God, maybe the guy made a big deal out of it, too.
Hey, look at this.
Oh, oops, my zipper's
down. Barn door's open.
And then he came back and went, oh, there's my penis. Barn door's open and the horse is out.
Okay.
Take a look at my enormous penis.
I have no end, so I'm just going to do this.
And my troubles start to melt.
No tag for that.
I take a look at my enormous penis. And everything is going my way.
By the way, the groundhog tradition apparently, so I guess in Europe it was originally hedgehogs. Because there are no groundhogs, at least it is groundhogs here because there are no hedgehogs here. So when they moved it here, they went, well,
what have you got?
Yeah, what do you got? Well, we got this thing.
What do you have that's hog-ish?
Hog-like. Hog-like. Fair enough. And they just dragged something out of its hole somewhere and waved it around in the sun and then, you know, and then drank. So, all right.
So the groundhog is probably called the groundhog because he is similar to the hedgehog.
And he lives underground. He burrows.
Right.
Okay, so they just, yeah, and they went. So that's just one of those things where they just named it. So it was just more hicks just coming over here and just naming things. It just sort of willy-nilly, just based on, you know.
It's a hedgehog. No, it's not. It's a in the groundhog.
All right, so there's that.
I don't know why it's, why is it called a, oh, I see. It's called a hedgehog because
lives near hedges.
No, because it's from the Middle English. And yeah, because it lives near hedge from hedge and hog because of its pig-like snout.
I don't know a lot of this world. I got me some hedgehog knowledge. That's one of my that'll be one of my dream Jeopardy categories, maybe.
They have also been called urchins, hedge pigs and furze pigs.
Hedge pig.
Hedge pig.
All right. It is the
adorable.
They really are. They really are. They really are adorable. It is. It is one of my great regrets, actually, that that my most recent hedgehog Ramon, that he did not live long enough to pose for a photo with my dogs, because that'd be the cutest thing ever.
It would.
Here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
A Maryland Heights man who is deaf had an interpreter report to police earlier this month that a man had broken the windshield of his car. What will Andrew? Now here you can help me with the last name here. His name Andrew. His last name is spelled S-T-C-Y-R. It seems like a letter is missing there, but
well, that's what is it like a like one of those Polish names where it's like where you know Stur or something or
yeah. Let's pronounce it Stur.
Stur.
Andrew Stur, 24, failed to have the caller mention, according to police, that he was trying to run over a man with his car at the time that the fellow broke his windshield. And he tried to run him over not once, but twice. Sure, of Maryland Heights faces felony charges of first-degree assault and armed criminal action. He was...
Also, he's allowed to drive even though he's deaf.
Well, yeah.
What is up with... Well, you can't wear headphones while you drive.
No,
that's illegal.
I guess deaf people are allowed to drive.
Oh, I see. Deaf people get all the advantages, don't they, Don?
Yeah, apparently he was driving around 1 p.m. on January 14th when James Richardson, 52, of St. Louis, noticed a Lincoln Town Car following closely behind his Ford Taurus. He stopped at the signal and Sturr began blowing his horn. Sturr then followed Richardson where he forced him to pull over. Sturr was not only blowing his horn but yelling at Richardson as well. Richardson exited his car, approached the Lincoln. Sturr drove into him, throwing him onto the hood and breaking the windshield. Richardson rolled off the hood, and then, according to police, Sturr drove into him again. Sturr left the scene. Richardson was taken to the hospital and then later released. And then the police were later contacted by an interpreter calling on behalf of Mr. Sturr, who reported that a man had smashed his windshield.
This is just one of those things that is, I mean, it's a story that would be moderately amusing otherwise, but the fact that the guy is deaf just instantly, like in the sort of like mini reel recreation of my head, makes it exponentially funnier.
And I'm just kind of... I want to know more about the why he made the decision to call the police and report the broken windshield when he had been did he think he was in the right?
I don't know. Well, it's like the guy
That bastard hit my windshield when I was running him down, and my windshield's broken now. I'm filing charges.
I think you're maybe making it a little more intelligible than it probably than the statement might have been. Also, that he's yelling at the guy, and presuming that he's like full on deaf and has always been that way, it's not like the yelling is going to have any effect. You're just going to think a porpoise is following you. So, I mean, what did you think that was going to? Unless it was just like an attention getting device to sort of you know make the guy turn around so he could aim the car, you know, like right at his midsection or something.
He could be mostly deaf and still able to like yell things, but just not able to use the telephone very well.
Well, maybe. Yeah. Let me ask you this. I was thinking about this last night. I was driving along and I had the being a knob. I had my the little headset thing for my phone in,
mm-hmm.
and it's you know it's like this is sort of like a knockoff of the Skullcandy thing because I smashed the other one in the car door. So I'm driving along and I was on the phone with my wife or whatever, and I was, you know, had it jammed into my ear, and then it's like you realize you're just being like that. You know, it's the gayest looking thing, just stuck in there, and then I'm being every douche that I've ever seen, where not only do I have the thing jammed into my ear to be on the phone, but then I'm like holding the little part of the wire up near my mouth as I'm walking, you know, getting out of the car and walking into the Safeway. You know, and I'm like, it's not enough that this just hangs down. I've got to do this so it looks like I'm one of those guys with like the army helmet that has the built-in microphone that I got to hold up next to my mouth. But I was thinking about this, how, you know, it's now illegal to, you can't just be on a cell phone. Like, you can't hold a cell phone up to your head and just be talking to that way you drive.
Right.
So it's got to be hands-free. And so then they, as a result of that hands-free law, then they just sell these things just by the fistful. And yet, it's also illegal to be using headphones while you drive. So that's a strange thing, that it's a law that we, so because of the one law, I think that cops must just now be de facto ignoring the other law. Because I was at one point in my life, this is years ago, but I have been pulled over for wearing headphones. It was when I drove this old beater car that had no radio, and I had like a Walkman or whatever. And I just like stuck headphones on when I was driving, you know, and I got pulled over for it at least once. It might have been more than that because it is. And I remember them drilling that into us in traffic safety class in high school, that you could not wear headphones or have any music listening device on or in your ear while you drove. And yet these are marketed as a way to keep yourself within the law while using your cell phone. So that's a little odd.
Yeah, I don't know, because I've heard from different people People have been saying that I've heard had people say that it was only over the ear headphones that were illegal, and I don't think that's true. I think that all, like, you know, earbuds and that sort of thing are also illegal.
Well, especially because the things that go in your ear block the sound almost totally.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I know that, I'll admit that, I've been known to use them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, yeah. You know. Yeah, and I'm then, not going to. Yeah,
and,
so do
and
I.
Then the, and then I don't have the little talkie thing on my my earbuds. So, you know, I'll just pick the phone up and hold it and speak into it like it's a walkie-talkie.
Like it's a communicator?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, that's not distracting while I'm driving.
Here's the reason you don't want to do that in public, because then you look like some douche nozzle from a reality TV show. Because that's, have you noticed that, and I guess it must be so the cameras can pick it up or so the lavalier mic can pick it up, but that is how every, like you watch the, you know, that goddamn Housewives of Whoreville, you know, or wherever it is, and it's like they all hold the phone. And I've noticed for some reason it is a thing that the female characters on reality shows tend to do more than men for some reason. I don't know why that is, but this is a thing that I've noticed, a phenomenon where the men will still hold the phone, but they'll kind of hold it like a phone, but away from their head. Sort of like you were holding a phone normally, but then you just put like about 6 inches of space. The women will tend to hold it out in front of them like they're scanning for coins at the beach with it or something.
Well, I wonder if they do that also because they're mic'd. First of all, they're mic'd for TV, and also, and also they don't want them to cover their faces.
Well, that's what you're saying. So, yeah, they obviously have to hold it away because the lavalier's got to pick it up.
Yeah.
But it is a thing of, like, the placement of the phone. Guys still tend to hold it up here even though they pull it away. Women tend to hold it out in front of them for some reason. And so I don't know why that is.
Well, I only do it, like, again, I'll only do it when I'm driving. And I hold it like this because I sort of feel – it's like I'm talking to a microphone. I'm actually holding here and talking
right.
Talking towards the mouth part.
Do you have it on speaker?
No, I'll be listening to it through my headphones.
Oh, so you can hear the call. You just can't actually speak back to it via the headphones. Did the headphones with your iPhone not come with the little thing?
Yeah, they did, but I don't use
those. Oh, you detest those because it's the hard plastic.
Right. They're really, really uncomfortable. So I had purchased these really comfortable, nice Skull Candy ones for Patrick's iPod Nano that I bought him, and I've just kind of stolen them basically to use on all the time now.
Excellent. By the way, we have this email in all caps. It says... It just says, "Holy effing S! Did Giorno Pizza now comes with cookie dough?" And then there's a link. So apparently,
so what, like you get a wad of frozen cookie dough in the same box as your frozen pizza.
Well, let me tell you, Don, DiGiorno frozen pizza and cookie dough together at last. Says this piece on I swear to God Salon.com. Supermarket pizza giant's new combo. Now is DiGiorno? That's a frozen pizza only thing, right?
Yeah.
Supermarket Pizza Giant's new combo pack serves up... Okay, I'm not even going to give you the calorie count. I'm going to read this, and then I'll go back and ask you. Let's see. It says, allow us to introduce a DiGiorno... Okay, this can't be a real product, and yet it is, because it's in the food column for Salon.com, and it's not like a gag. It actually there's a video that goes along with this, but it says, let us introduce... And there's the label, DiGiorno... Pizza and cookies. It's X calories worth of frozen pizza sitting cheek by jowl, they say, in a box with another blank calories worth of Nestle Toll House chocolate chip cookie dough. So it doesn't look like they are merged together into one food, but it's like a TV dinner except it's a frozen pizza. And so you get the frozen pizza and then side by side in the box it is next to. So you basically pop the whole thing, the whole contents in the oven, and when it's done... You not only have the pizza, but then you have a huge serving of Toll House cookies to go along with
now,
it.
Now, is this a single serving thing?
Oh, no.
I was just trying to figure...
For who?
Well, no, I'm just thinking, is it a full-sized frozen pizza and then cookie dough, or it's...
I'm looking at the calorie count.
It's a pizza for you and cookie dough for you.
It does not look... Based on the calorie count, it does not look as though this is like a meal for one.
Okay.
The box contains... it looks like 3,700 calories.
Okay.
So I am guessing. And that pizza, that Safeway pizza, the large Safeway frozen pizza is 3,400 calories. So even if you, even if you're being generous and saying that this is a little more healthful.
So this is a small-ish pizza, which they're still going to say serves like 4 or 5 people.
The pizza itself is 2,300 calories.
Yeah.
So, and then the cookies are another 1,500 calories.
So it's like an 8-inch pizza instead of, let's say, a 12 or 14-inch pizza.
I don't know. I just like the idea that you can get the two things at once. See, because where most people sort of view this as like a bad thing or the sign of the impending apocalypse, or it's like, you know, what are they? This is why they hate us. We've got pizza and cookies together. That, to me, this is what our ancestors, this is why we stole this country, so that we could create foods like this and I could buy them for less than you might expect at the supermarket on the way home.
So I have never understood why you can get cookie dough at like the Papa Murphy's pizza place. It doesn't, those, because cookies and pizza just don't make sense to me as a pairing. They just don't. And I mean, I guess it's like, okay, I guess the logical thing is we're selling you something that you're going to go home and bake yourself.
If you have to bake it, though, maybe that's the thing.
Yeah, so we might as well sell you cookie dough that you can bake yourself as well. But it still seems just odd that you would get pizza and cookie dough at like the same place.
I guess. I mean, unless they just unless that is a thing. Unless it's a thing that we have, when I say we, that I mean that has become widespread because they started it. In other words, like, is it Papa Murphy? I always confuse Papa Murphy and the other one. What's the Papa something or Papa John? One of them is you make it yourself, and one of them is whatever. But the place where you got to take it and bake it, maybe that's a thing that they started because it was like their trademark. It was a thing that like Murphy himself used to enjoy, and then it just became widespread from there. I don't know why. What the hell is Humpty Dumpty an egg?
I know, it's like when I first moved here and went to Skipper's for the one and only time I've ever been at Skipper's, and I bought whatever this fish product was that they had there.
This fish product.
Well, it was some, you know, something.
I think it might be called fish.
And then they asked me, what did I want for a side order? And they said, do you want coleslaw or Jell-O? And I was like, how are those my options?
Right.
How are the options coleslaw or Jell-O?
You know why? Because there's nobody who has bland taste. Well, I mean, there's Mormons. But you know who has really, really bland taste? Catholics. You know who constitutes like 80% of Skipper's business? Catholics. Mm. So you know where I spent every goddamn Friday of my life growing up when my mom didn't feel like cooking? Skipper's. Why? Catholic. So, and you would go to the Skipper's, which is still there, by the way, on the main drag in Kennewick. You go to the main street there, and there's a Skipper's, and it's every Friday. The place is just packed with, I mean, it's like the line is out and around the building sometimes on Friday. Because that's really the only place. It's the only place you're going to go that serves what we refer to as meatless, even in some alternate reality where fish isn't a meat somehow. Where they serve meatless dinners, and it's not upscale like your Sea Galley, because that's for the fancy folk from Panoramic Heights.
Wow,
where Old Man Withers lives.
I just equated it because it was an experience I had when I first moved here. So I sort of equated it with just Oregon cuisine because it was the first time I went to a Mexican food restaurant and discovered that people in Oregon don't have very little concept of what actual hot means when it comes to food. And also I went to lunch with some friends to an Elmer's and I ordered a BLT and it came with shredded lettuce on it.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is wrong with this state?
No, the thing about like the hot sauce, that's not really so much that Oregon people are pussies. It's just that California is the aberration there. It's not Oregon that's the aberration. California and certain southern states are aberrant in terms of their use of spice and pepper. The rest of the country, and I know that, again, having lived in Utah, and maybe Utah's the other end of the spectrum, but the rest of the country has a totally – most people in this world have a completely flawed idea of what spicy means. You know, it's like, where you know, do you want Tabasco? You know, what am I, a daredevil? And it's like they just can't – it has been an ongoing – which I actually solved some years ago, but for many, many years, it was like an ongoing quest to try to find a sauce somewhere that was hot enough. And that's one of those things where it's like everybody has some damn sauce that they would recommend. It was like the hottest sauce, and they all have a picture on the front of like a woman with a whip, you know, and a cat of nine tails, and like the devil and flames and a donkey like kicking you in the head or something. And then it was basically just Tabasco sauce. Yeah. So it took me a while before I did sort of, and with the internet, it's become a lot easier, but with finding like gourmet hot sauces that are actually unbelievably hot, which is sort of the way that I like everything.
Have you ever been to Campbell's Barbecue over by the Sport Plaza?
That place will take the skin off the inside of your mouth.
They're hot. Barbecue sauce will harm
It'll
you.
It'll kill you.
And I mean, it'll harm you in that, like, I wanted to try it, and they were like, okay, now we're warning you. It's really hot. And I said, well, could I get just a little bit on the side?
Yeah.
And I just dripped a little bit of it in with my other barbecue sauce and thought it was going to, like, take the skin off the inside of my mouth.
It was – that place – I mean, when I say that it was terrible, I mean, it was great because
their food is wonderful.
I love their food, and their food is – and it is – it's on Powell and, like, 60th?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, Powell and 70th, maybe?
It's right across from the DMV that's over by the Eastport Plaza Shopping Center.
Yeah, so if you're on Powell, just head toward 82nd, you'll see it's on the left. And there's a picture of, like, the sort of kindly couple that runs the place out front. It says Campbell's. And there's, like, this great sort of, like, quasi-sepia-toned photo of them. But I went there, and it's like, I should have known better because I've gotten screwed a time or two in the past on this where I will be, you know, like, real cocky about, you know, and guys tend to do this anyway, where, you know, guys will be like real macho about their food intake. Like, it's always some idiot guy that wants to eat like the old 97er that's like the steak that's 70 pounds or something.
Of course I can do it. I'm a man.
Exactly.
My stomach somehow defies the laws of physics.
You know, your stomach's not a bag of holding, friend. There's only so much that can fit inside there. But I went to, years ago, I went to this Thai place in Salt Lake. And you think, Salt Lake, like, how hot can it be? What I didn't really think about at the time is that in Salt Lake, there's a lot of people who have, largely because of the church, spent years abroad, and then they come home and they want to recreate the cuisine they had in other countries. Mm. And so they will actually, like, serve very authentic restaurants that serve, you know, like, in this case, Thai food. And apparently the guys, it turned out, had brought, like, the chefs were all from Thailand and whatever.
And those little Thai peppers will kill you.
I was like 20, 21, and just, you know, and just totally, like, you know, just totally a jackass anyway. But of course, you know, again, nothing was ever hot enough, especially in Salt Lake, because, you know, my mom added lots and lots of pepper to everything. And so I just never had a thing growing up that didn't have red peppers chopped up in it or chili peppers chopped up in it. And I just – I thought that's how everything was. So anyway, so the guy's like, you know, well, here you got your salmon curry and your lemongrass chicken curry and your whatever. And it was like the thing about – they put the little legend of like 1 through 5 peppers for the heat. And I go, well, what's the hottest? He goes, well, 1 is mild and then 5 is the hottest. And I go, bring me the 5. And he's like, no. He's like, you don't – this guy Dennis, he's like, you don't want the 5. And I was like, I can handle the 5. And he says, no. He's like, the 5 is unbelievable. He's like, my cooks don't even eat the 5. You don't want that. And of course, I'm just such an arrogant jackass. I'm like, okay, friend, bring me your 4. You know, I guess I'll just scale it down if you're so worried about my tender constitution. And so he's like, okay. And it was that tone of voice, like the your funeral kind of a thing. And he goes back, and it was that kind of restaurant where you could see into the kitchen. And I look over into the kitchen, and he's talking to the guys who are working back there. And it was like, I couldn't hear them or probably wouldn't have understood them anyway. But it was the thing where, like, the chef is sort of going like, he what? And he, like, pointed at me. And the chef looked out at me and then looked back at him and goes, him? And, like, jerks his thumb over my direction. And then eventually it was sort of a, okay. And then they whipped the food up and they brought it out. And all I really remember, it was really hot anyway. I mean, all of the food was really hot. But it was, I got, like, and it's the thing where you get, like, 3 forkfuls in. And especially with curry, it takes a second to sort of, like, it's like a backdraft where it's like, you know, and then it comes back out. I got, like, 3 forkfuls in, and I didn't even say, like, ow, or like, oh, my God. I just did that sort of, like, ha, ha. It was like a paralytic sort of a reaction where I could not breathe. And suddenly I'm just sweating, and it's like I just feel like there's fire coming up in my larynx. And suddenly Dennis, the owner, just appears at my corner, just sort of, you know, it just sort of appears like a sort of like David Niven, just going like, and so how's that 4 working out for you then? And he produced from behind his back. I was there with a bunch of the guys from the radio station, and so we were probably just being dicks to begin with, but he produced from behind his back like a plate of what they call glass noodles, which are like a cooling dish because they bond to the oil and take it off your tongue. And he said, I've got these glass noodles. They're a cooling dish, but you probably don't need these, seeing as how you're such a big, tough guy. And I was there with a friend of mine. He was a guy who shaved his head all the time, so he was totally hairless on top, and his head was, like, streaming sweat down the side. It was just a thoroughly unpleasant experience, so I should have known better. And then I went to Campbell's years later, and I did exactly the same thing, where the woman tried to warn me. She's like, baby, you don't want the five. It's very hot. Bring it on. And as you said, it's fantastic. But it took me weeks and weeks and weeks to go back to that place because I was burned literally so badly by that food.
Yeah, I was very happy that I asked for the hot, like, on the side and just tried a little bit of it. And I was like, oh, my God. Oh, my Lord. And I have a pretty high tolerance for heat. And this is like, because, you know, you go to Campbell's, they have the mild, the brown sugar, which is kind of medium hot, but very sweet. They're medium and then hot. And it's like, honestly, you stay away from the hot. That stuff is... It's industrial strength.
Yeah, it'll kill you dead. All right, we got to wrap things up. Actually, there's a bunch of stuff we're not going to get through today, but I got to do the clue number three here, and then we'll end this. Did you say that sugar was stuck in your head all day yesterday?
It was indeed.
Good. Well, I'm sure it wasn't.
At least for about an hour or so after I left.
The fine folks at EH Vending are bringing this to you. This is clue number three for the EH Vending Name That Snack contest, and of course, if you're the first person to correctly identify the snack which we are describing come Friday, once we've given out Friday's clue, then you will win yourself a big heaping helping of items, consumables, and wondrous edible bits of magic from EH Vending. We got the gift bags over here in the corner of the studio. And if you are a business owner, your business operator, you are the person who calls the shots at your place, if you run the joint, and if your employees are amazing, you know, looking around, you know, and they're going to lunch, or they're walking out of the plaid pantry, or people are just getting a little peckish later in the afternoon, one little nosh, and there's nothing there. A, you know, you lose some little time and productivity. People are, you know, walk out of the business, they got to, you know, go to lunch. Then it's like 10 minutes there, 10 minutes back, half an hour to eat. Suddenly you can just find yourself losing an hour and a half of work time. Or if you are an employee, actually, and you find that, you know, they got rid of the vending machine, and the vending machine you have now is crap, and it's just filled with, it's filled with things that nobody wants. I mean, it's just, where it's just like nothing but those, what are those, hot tamales or whatever? Like the little, like the red, like the red Mike and Ikes or whatever. I mean, I guess those are okay, but like, who really wants a lot of those?
No one. And if you're feeling like, you know, peckish, you want something snacky.
Yeah,
that doesn't really do it.
It's like eating a whole box of Junior Mints. I've never gotten that. So. So if you are unhappy with your current vending provider, they're charging too much, you never see them, they don't get back to you, or maybe you're trying to cut corners a little bit, you're trying to, you're trying to tighten the belt, trying to make your business run a little more effectively, and you find that you're just, you're not able to do that with your current vending provider because they don't want to scale down what they're charging, EH Vending will find a way to make it work, and they are longtime listeners of the show, so they're good people. It is EHVending.com. You call them for appointments or service anytime at all. Josh can be reached at 360-816-1853 or James at 503-897-8204. So once again, once Friday comes, we give Friday's clue. If you're the first person to correctly identify this snack via snack at rickemerson.com, you'll win yourself a big gift bag of consumables from EH Vending. Today's clue is salty. Here's today's clue.
I know what it is. Oh, wait, I already knew what it was. Right.
Today's clue is salty. Excellent. All right, we got to wrap it up. We want to thank our guests today, including, Willamette Week's Kelly Clark. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Anna Griffin, columnist from The Oregonian. And Friday, Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the studio with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. This Friday, talking about the life and legacy of Mr. Flip Wilson. Next Tuesday, Joel Carter from the FX series Justified. So lots of good things on the horizon. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News episode, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good things. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. Listen to Don Taylor 4 o'clock this afternoon, that is 4 p.m. Pacific time at Cascadia.fm for Hamfisted Radio or at HamfistedRadio.com. The Rick Emerson Show, of course, made possible by a generous grant from y'all, so thank you for listening, and do spread the word. Please try to tell two people about this fine radio experience, won't you? It is Wednesday, February 2nd, 2011, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. As always, thanks for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.